This is a Day One podcast extra, bringing you a conversation between our host, Peter Wallace, and a special guest. For more information about Day One, which brings you outstanding preachers from America's mainline Protestant churches, visit our website at dayone.org.
Welcome to the Day One Podcast Extra. This is Peter Wallace, and with me today is the Reverend Dr. William J. Carl III. Since 2005, Bill has served as president of Pittsburgh Theological Seminary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. For 22 years before that, he was senior pastor of First Presbyterian Church in Dallas, Texas. He's also been an adjunct professor at Austin Theological Seminary in Austin, Texas, and for 7 years taught homiletics, worship, and New Testament Greek at Union Seminary in Virginia. Bill is the author of several books, including Dancing in Holy Places and The Lord's Prayer for Today. Bill, thanks for being with us.
Great to be with you, Peter.
You earned your undergraduate degree from the University of Tulsa in your home state of Oklahoma.
Largest Presbyterian school in the country, by the way.
Okay.
Tulsa.
And your degree was in religion, philosophy, and Greek, and then you went on to Louisville Seminary for your Master of Divinity, then on to the University of Pittsburgh for a PhD in rhetoric and communication. But first of all, what drew you into the study of religion in the first place?
Well, that's an interesting question. I'm a PK, and my dad, who's still active as a pastor at 85 years of age in the Bartlesville, Tulsa area, was a wonderful mentor in many ways. Now, as a PK, I was not going to go into the ministry, of course.
Of course.
And I went off to the University of Tulsa as a music major to start with, and just had a great time starting out with that. But I had to take a religion course as part of the curriculum, and I fell in love with it. The professor, John Gammy, who's now deceased and who ended up being also my Greek professor, was so exciting, so much fun. And I realized, as all PKs do eventually, oh, there are other people talking about this besides your mom or your dad. And so I jumped right in and really loved it.
And then when did the sense of call to ministry come about?
I started preaching at 18 years of age in little towns around Tulsa. And I preached every Sunday. They sent us out from the University of Tulsa in this program that was sort of pre-ministerial training. And I'll never forget, the very first Sunday I went to Coweta, Oklahoma, and there were 10 people there. And I remember one time when there were three, and that was back when we gave 30-minute sermons back in 1967. And I just dumped the whole load out of them, on them, all 30 minutes each, or 10 minutes each. But anyway, I had a wonderful experience getting to know what it's like to preach. And I think the very first Sunday I got up in the pulpit in Coweta, Oklahoma, I knew this was what I was supposed to do. And I felt that sense of call right that moment.
After 22 years in the pastorate at First Presbyterian in Dallas, you came back to Pittsburgh Seminary as president. And we talked a little bit about that on the Day One program, but I'm curious as to how you've experienced God's call and direction throughout your career since those early days.
Yeah. You know, that great line, if you want to make God laugh, just tell God your plans.
Right.
I had really never intended having a job like this, and even never really even intended teaching in a seminary. But as I finished my PhD, I got a call to come interview for a job at Union Seminary. I was teaching at Pittsburgh Seminary at the time and was fully expecting to go be a pastor. And then I got this call from Union, and I went down, and I thought, wow, what an incredible place it was, and exciting faculty, and a wonderful place to be. And I thought, well, I can do this for a while and then go preach. And in fact, that's exactly what I did. I taught for about 7 years. Then the call came to the church in Dallas, and I thought, what an exciting place to go do that. There, I said, I'll do this for 10 years and go back to teach. But I ended up staying 22. So again, you can't know exactly where you're going to go or what's going to happen. The call that I feel here is that everything I have done in my life up to this point all comes together in one position, and it's very exciting.
Now, I noticed you wrote an article titled What Seminaries Need in a President, which was published, I believe, a couple of years before you became a seminary president.
Right.
What was your advice, and are you finding it helpful now?
Well, I you take my own advice. It's what I have to do. I wrote that as a seminary board member. I was on the board at the time of Louisville Presbyterian Seminary, and I thought there are searches going on. You know, search committees mm-hmm. ought to have some advice. So I came up with some different images that I used. Usually you talk administrator, leader, whatever. I was trying to come up with some biblical images that I thought would fit, and I came up with the judge from the Hebrew Bible or Old mm-hmm. Testament and the rabbi from the New Testament, because you think, you know, the president should be the sort of chief mm-hmm. teacher but chief learner also. Mm-hmm. And I had several other images that I used from Scripture and from church history. For example, I think in a monastery, the abbot has to have street smarts and be very savvy about how to lead as an administrator and be able to be patient and listen with all the different types of people. Servant leader is another image that I thought was very important. So, yeah, I'm having to live what I wrote, practice what I preached.
One of the things that the seminary has been through recently is the development of a new mission and vision statement. Why did you do that, and how did you do that?
Well, Pittsburgh Seminary had the same mission statement for a long time, and like all the other 256 theological institutions in North America, it was a long dissertation that no one could remember. And so I said, we're going to have a new mission statement, and I want one sentence that even the custodians can remember and recite at gunpoint between the first and second floor of the elevator. And so I said, also, we want to have a lot of people involved in the process, so we'll build ownership. We started with the faculty. We moved to students and alums and administrators and staff. We included administrative assistants and custodial staff, everybody. And we did it all over the country, but still going for one sentence, which is a challenge. Well, we finally got to one sentence, which I know you've had a chance to look at, and notice that it doesn't start with the name of the seminary. It starts with this phrase, on a dynamic and challenging global stage, Pittsburgh Seminary plays its part in God's redemption of the world through Jesus Christ, and so forth. The whole point of it is, God's doing something out there. And so the opening line of the vision statement is, the question is not, what are we doing on this 13-acre campus? The question is, what is God doing out there in the world, and how can we play a part in it? So the whole emphasis is on global mission, and we have a big program on that in World Mission Initiative. It's now driving our strategic plan and our new direction at the seminary.
Bill, you do a lot of writing. You have numerous books out. Your latest, I believe, is Dancing in Holy Places. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that book.
Well, it's really a book of sermons that I was invited to publish. And they're sermons through a certain season of the year. And so, interestingly enough, they tend to fit some of the First Samuel and mm-hmm. the passages about David later. And what I'm doing is I'm just picking up, and Dancing in Holy Places, which is the title, is from one of the sermons where David is dancing around the Ark of the Covenant. And it's I think most of the sermons in that book, most of the chapters are Old Testament or Hebrew Bible. There's just one that's in the New. It's interesting in our time, in our church, to preach the Hebrew Bible in such a way that you remember you are in a Christian church, without making Jesus Christ just a poor rubber stamp mm-hmm. you stick at the end. So where is the Christology even in the Hebrew Bible? And so that's part of what I'm doing in that book.
And you won the 2002 Telluride Indie Fest screenwriting contest. So are we going to see you in Hollywood someday?
Well, I've actually been in some conversation with some agents. This came about because I had written a novel, which I'm still working to publish, and to learn how to tighten the novel, I learned how to write screenplays. And so I wrote a screenplay on that particular novel. Then I wrote another screenplay. The first one is an action, sort of espionage-type novel, a sort of Tom Clancy, mm-hmm. Frederick Forsyth, Robert Ludlum meet Indiana Jones kind of story. In fact, the novel version is about an assassin who becomes a minister and then is pulled back into his old world of espionage and murder. and we're still working on getting that one published. But the screenplay for which I won the Telluride Indie Fest screenwriting contest is a romantic comedy. It's about a matchmaker, a small-town busybody matchmaker named Maggie Binder, who finds out she's dying and tries to match her husband, Herb, with someone before she's gone. And when she does match him with her much younger hospice nurse, Angela, and they are kind of embarrassed and the whole small town is talking about it, she shoves them out on dates. And the moment they fall deeply in love, she finds out she's going to live.
Oh.
And the whole third act is how do they unravel the dilemma. So it's called Maggie's Perfect Match, and I hope you'll see that someday on the screen.
Well, you're quite the Renaissance man.
Well, I don't know about that.
I'd like to explore a bit more with you about the subject of ethics. You consult with medical centers and corporations. So much of your work involves medical ethics, which is an area of great discussion these days. How did your interest in ethics arise?
I sort of stumbled into it. I was invited by someone in Dallas to come and work with a company that was in a crisis situation. And as I mentioned when we were talking earlier, one of the interesting things about companies is they have a lot of gray area decisions where they have to make the right choice, not only for the bottom line, but for the future of the institution. And so I came in and they said, we've got all these other people helping us, but we want you to help us figure out what is the right thing to do in this situation. And once we moved that direction, it helped with the crisis. They solved the crisis, and they ended up getting a lot more revenue than they ever thought.
Well, what are some of the major issues you tend to work on in the consulting, specific areas of ethical life?
Well, the ones I work on aren't dealing with stem cell research or any of the kinds of typical things. They tend to be crisis situations where the company has had to make a decision about how to deal with the customer or how to, and because of confidentiality agreements, I can't go into all the details. But I have worked with a company that is wanting to build an ethical culture from the ground up. So they started having me come in, not in a crisis situation, but in a situation where they're working on the positive way to go about being a better company. And that was pretty exciting.
And then the whole area of science, you've written an article, you have a lecture, Brains, Bodies, Beliefs, and Behavior, which is fascinating. What's the thrust of your argument?
Well, it's a philosophical and ethical perspective on the mind-body equation, contrasting a more Hellenistic Cartesian dualism that separates mind and body and has physicians looking at patients as very uninteresting appendages to very interesting diseases, over against a more Hebraic, holistic approach to the patient that has the doctor looking at the whole patient and actually helps the healing process. Harold Koenig at Duke has actually proven that it helps the healing process if the doctor cares about you as a whole person. So I'm sort of a one-man show going around the country trying to help change medical education so doctors will look at the whole person. Doesn't mean dumb down the clinical, you know, more scientific side. We really want that done well, but we also want to care about the whole person. And so I give this lecture at medical schools and medical conferences. Thankfully, many medical schools are beginning to realize this, and they're actually adding courses. And we're going to be having conversations soon, even in Pittsburgh, in this relationship.
So how should healthcare providers and clergy or any people of faith work together as partners with God in the process of bringing healing to a broken and hurting world?
One of the things that I point out in this particular lecture and in another lecture that deals with different religions and how you deal with patients depending on what their religion is, one of the points I bring out at the very end is that the Greek word for salvation, soteria, really means wholeness, health, peace, harmony. In many ways, it's a synonym of the Hebrew word shalom and the Arabic word salam, you know, the greeting salam aleikum, aleikum salam. And it's not just healing, peace, wholeness just for the individual. It's also for the whole community. So what I say to physicians is, we're working together here on bringing health to the whole community. We're coming at it from a theological side. You're coming at it from a medical side. And we're co-partners in trying to bring health, which is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Bill Carl, thanks so much for talking with us.
Great to talk with you, Peter.